Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out the events page. Now, I don't know. By the time we're recording this, I mean, I don't know if there's going to be any tickets left to this Northwest Arkansas event. But maybe there are. If you were wanting to go, you better check right now and make sure that you got a ticket. Because, Chad, there are very few tickets left to this thing. And you want to come and hang out with Chad and me and a whole bunch of other people as we talk about the gospel April 16th and 17th. See if you can make it. Chad, we're starting a new book, but this one feels different than any other new book that we've started. You know, I mean, we've moved from, you know, Genesis to Exodus and Exodus to Leviticus, and we've done all of this sort of thing. And some of those books like kind of seem like, you know, they're continuing of the story and stuff. But none of them like this, where it's literally a book where you're getting the sequel to it. It's so connected to the prior book that they just have to give it the same name.
Yeah, we're beginning a new book, but it's a little anticlimactic.
Yeah.
I mean, it just kind of feels like you're turning the page to the next chapter. So, but I mean, I will say this, that, I mean, this is a definite point where you would want to divide the books, mm-hmm. put it that way. For numerous reasons. For the first reason, of course, the most obvious reason, as we talked about in the last episode, is that Saul has just died. And 1 Samuel, as we've discussed many times, was not so much about Samuel as it was about Saul and David. So this is a transition chapter. We're officially leaving Saul behind. There will be more talk of his death in this chapter, as well as a very moving lament that David writes and sings. So we'll talk more about Saul in this chapter, but really is the transition chapter to move beyond him, beyond the Saul David story, to just the David story. Even though, even in that story, we still have about 7.5 years of waiting before David is the king of all of Israel. One thing I noticed just today that sets this particular chapter apart and connects it with some other pretty pivotal historical changes is that the way this book begins, the way that 2 Samuel chapter 1 begins, is like this: after the death of Saul, or as a New American Standard has it, now it came about after the death of Saul. So that particular phraseology is the beginning of three biblical books. That's the way that Joshua begins, after the death of Moses. That's the way that Judges begins, after the death of Joshua. And then that's the way, of course, 2 Samuel is going to begin, after the death of Saul. Just out of curiosity, I did a search on that Hebrew phrase, which is Vahiyi Achrei Mot, so after the death of so-and-so. And pretty fascinating. So that occurs in those three passages I just cited: Joshua 1:1, Judges 1:1, and now 2 Samuel 1:1. And it also occurs in Genesis 25:11, which is after the death of Abraham. So what's fascinating about all four of those occurrences is that we have a marker, a historical marker, that points us to the passing of a highly significant person. So after the death of Abraham, Moses, Joshua, and Saul. I mean, it's pretty hard to find four names that are bigger than those four guys. So for that reason alone, it is a great place to kind of divide the story of Samuel, even though we're not completely finished with Saul. It was a good place to make this transition. So anyway, in the last episode, in the last chapter of 1 Samuel, we talked about the occasion of Saul's death, and not just Saul, but of course his sons, as well as a whole lot of other Israelites, as you had this devastating defeat of the Israelites by the Philistines there at Mount Gilboa. And David, of course, is at the opposite end geographically from where this place is. He's way down south. He's in Ziklag. You remember that he had to go and rescue his people, and in the process, destroy a bunch of the enemy who had come and raided his village while he was gone. So he's far removed from this and was of course, unaware, completely unaware of the death of Saul. He didn't have any idea what was going on. I think it's a little bit hard for us in a modern setting to appreciate the fact that up until recently, some major events could have gone down, I mean, in our own country, and it took us a little while for us to find out. I'm 50 years old, so it wasn't like I grew up with the internet, but even now I'm so accustomed to, with a few clicks on my phone, to find out what's happening anywhere, that it's kind of hard to, I have to remind myself on an ongoing basis that this is weird and strange and radically modern. And that before this, you know, you find out things when you found them out. You know, the newspaper age, or the telegraph age, or the letter age, whatever it might have been. Well, now, of course, in 2 Samuel, the only way they're going to find out something is by word of mouth, by a messenger bringing this news.
Yeah, this is very recent that we were able to have it be any other way than just waiting to hear from somebody. I just so happen to live in a Civil War town. You know, there's a right next to a national park, military park, and if you go there and learn about the battle that took place there and everything, one of the things you'll find is that one of the sides of the battle is waiting for their supply lines to get there. They're just waiting. They're supposed to be there. They're supposed to come. They do not come because they got attacked, you know, 50 miles from where they're supposed to be. You have no way of knowing this. You have no way of finding this out. Like, it doesn't show up. I mean, eventually you find out, but you're just trusting that, well, they should be here when they should be here at this time. And when they don't get there, then you're just in big, huge trouble because you don't have the stuff you need. And, I mean, and that was like 150 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hugely significant events could happen in your near vicinity that really directly affected you. And it could be days, weeks, possibly even months before you actually find out what happened. And that's the case here with David. I mean, could there be any more significant event in the life of David than the death of Saul? The guy who was king and who now, because he's dead, can no longer be king. And the next in line, the one that has already been anointed as king and chosen by God, is David. But David has no clue that this has happened. But we find out in chapter 1 how David does discover this. And it's a fascinating story because of everything that we know about kind of the details of how this happens and the guy that brings the news. And we'll see how David reacts to him and talk about how he could have reacted had he chosen to, and why it's important that he acted the way that he did. Okay, so here's how it starts out. So after the death of Saul, David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites. Now keep this in mind. He's just got back from wiping out these Amalekites, right? That's going to become important when we find out who this messenger is. And David stayed there in his kind of borrowed town of Ziklag, where he's been staying with his men for a little over a year, this Philistine city. On the third day, so it's been back a couple days, third day, typical, by the way, of the Bible to locate big events or important events on the third day.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, when you read in the New Testament that Paul says that Christ was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, just keep that in mind. There is no very explicit prophecy in the Old Testament that Christ would be raised on the third day. I mean, you're not going to find that in Isaiah 53 or Psalm 22 or anything like that. What you will find, according to the scriptures, is over and over and over again, significant, highly important events happen on the third day.
You can even say that Jesus being raised on the third day is generous.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not even quite 2 days, right? If you're going by hours.
Yeah, you definitely cannot. You don't count up the hours and expect that to add up.
No, it doesn't work. Yeah. Does not work like that. Yeah. But it's Friday night to, you know, Sunday morning. I guess that's 3 days if you look at it just right. But the reason I think that Jesus says it, the reason that Paul says it, is because of this. This is a very, it's to unify the scriptures, right?
Yeah, just if you have any kind of Bible app or Logos or whatever you might have, just do a search sometime. Search for 3 days or third day and look at the context, see what's happening, and it'll become pretty clear what Paul means when he says according to the scriptures. Meaning he didn't have to cite some particular chapter and verse because it's all over the place. So anyway, that's kind of the background here of this happening on the third day. So on the third day, this guy shows up. He comes out of the camp from Saul, and it's pretty obvious that he's in bad shape, or that he's mourning, or that he just came from battle or something, because his clothes are torn. He's got dust on his head. That, by the way, would be typical signs of, in the biblical world, of someone who's in a state of grief or mourning. Of course, we have multiple occasions in the Bible where somebody hears some bad news and they tear their garments or they put dust on their head. So whether he was doing this out of mourning or maybe he looked just bedraggled, like he was obviously come from a battle or whatever the case was, this is the way he looks. So he comes to David and he falls on the ground before him, prostrates himself before David. So David says to him, where'd you come from? And he says, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. And we got to keep in mind through this whole kind of dialogue that, you know, at this point, we don't know anything about this guy. So if you know the story, just assume you don't know the story. Just kind of go with the flow of the story. So all we know now is this guy shows up. He's obvious in bad shape. He falls down before David, so he knows who David is, obviously. And he says, I've escaped from the camp of Israel. So what's your first assumption? Well, he's an Israelite, probably a soldier who has fled from the battle. So David says to him, well, how did things go? Please tell me. So, you know, he's looking for news. And the guy says, the people have fled from the battle. And also, many of the people have fallen and are dead. And then, of course, he saves the most important for last. He says, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also. So if you're David and you're hearing this, your heart's going to skip a beat, no doubt, for different reasons with regard to Saul and Jonathan. But still, David, though, wants to know for sure, right? This guy could just be making this up. So he says to him, how do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? And this is the story the guy tells. He says, by chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and behold, Saul was leaning on his spear, and the chariots and the horsemen pursued him closely. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me, and I said, here I am. And he said to me, so Saul said to this guy, who are you? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. Right away, our ears should perk up when we hear that word. So this is what the guy supposedly said to Saul. So verse 9, he said to me, please stand beside me and kill me, for agony has seized me, because my life still lingers in me. So I stood beside him and killed him, because I knew that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown, which was on his head, and the bracelet, which was on his arm, and I brought them here to my Lord.
Now, let me see if I can interpret what I'm gonna give you what I think actually happened here. You let me know what you think.
We have not talked about this. We'll see if our ideas line up.
Yeah, this is not true.
We're in agreement so far.
This is not true.
We are full agreement on that.
So this is not how we heard. This is not how it was told to us at the end of 1 Samuel. This is not how Saul died. It seems to me what you have here is a guy who has bought David's ruse so much and believes that David really, really doesn't like Saul, really hates Saul. It seems that it is possible that this is a guy who came upon the body of Saul, stole stuff off of it, left it there, went and found David with this stuff, told him this story, thinking that David would think that, oh, good, this is the guy who killed my arch nemesis, the person I hate most in the world, Saul. This guy has a plan to sort of win over the favor of David. This is the only explanation I can come up with. So maybe you have a better one, Chad, but this is what it seems like. And by the way, this is a huge miscalculation on this guy's part.
Yeah. Yeah, as we'll see as the story goes on, he could not possibly have been more mistaken with regard to how David's going to respond to this. But yeah, we are in full agreement.
Okay, there you go.
I think that's exactly what happened. Now, if you read, I don't know if this is so much believed anymore or not by kind of some of the more left-leaning critics of the scriptures. They'll claim these are two conflicting accounts of what really happened. Well, yeah, they are conflicting accounts, but they're conflicting because one of them's true and one of them's told by a liar.
Well, one of them is told in the voice of the narrator.
Yes.
The other is told is out the mouth of some guy in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Who, if you have just read First Samuel, it seems to me that you're supposed to pick up that this is not what happened.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious that, especially when you consider who this guy is. This is not an Israelite. This is an Amalekite. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, how does the chapter begin? David has just returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites.
Yep.
Number one. Of course, this guy doesn't know that. Maybe he doesn't really know what David thinks of the Amalekites. So he's not aware of that.
Well, you've not given any good things to think about the Amalekites thus far in 40 minutes in the Old Testament.
Right. And Well, I'll get to it in a minute about some of the irony here of his identity. But yeah, to go back to what you think happened, I think that's fully what happened. I think this guy's a scavenger.
Yep.
So, well, first of all, how do you by chance happen upon a battle? Come on. You could hear the battle probably for miles. you're not going to accidentally happen upon Mount Gilboa and just see Saul leaning on his spear. And then Saul say to you, I'll keep this in mind. So according to this story, after this guy identifies himself as an Amalekite, Saul asks him to kill him. I mean, come on. Is there anyone worse to kill Saul than Amalekite from Saul's perspective? I mean, it was the Amalekites that led to his downfall because he didn't slaughter the Amalekites, didn't carry out what Samuel told him to do. That's the reason he was removed from being king, or told that he would be removed from being king.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to ask your armor bearer, who you assume is also your friend, it's over for me, do me the biggest favor ever and kill me. It's very different. I mean, you could imagine, you might be able to place yourself in that situation where you would maybe put that request forward to your friend.
Yeah.
The sure. last person, though, I don't care like how hurt you are, you're not going to let your enemy do it.
No. Especially an Amalekite.
That's not how this works. You don't ask your enemy to put you out of your misery. Like, that's something you ask your friend to do so that your enemy doesn't.
Yeah. This is a story always to remember about the danger of concocting a lie, because this guy has come up with what he thinks is a believable story, which is just full of lies with, you know, a few scattered elements of truth. But he didn't do a very good job. He needed to do a little bit more background before he concocted this lie, because it's going to blow up in his face.
Well, he's just miscalculated how David feels about Saul, which is sort of understandable, I guess. You probably think that a lesser man than David would hate Saul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, this guy has every reason to think surely David hates Saul.
Yeah, and there's also this element which just gives even kind of more weight to this whole story. He shows up not just with the message, oh, by the way, thought I'd let you know Saul's dead. He shows up with the crown. So here's an Amalekite holding a crown, as well as probably what was like a regal bracelet. Had, you know, some sort of regal insignia on it, perhaps. But he's got the crown. He's got the bracelet. So he's more or less put himself in a position where he, an Amalekite, who claims to have killed the king of Israel, is now handing the royal insignia to the next king.
It seems to me that there's a chance that this guy is some kind of a Amalekite deserter. Like maybe his own people aren't too fond of him. Maybe he's not. Maybe he got left. Maybe he's on the run, and he has decided that, you know what I could do? I could get in good with the future king of Israel, and then maybe I could be something. So if you're the guy that brings this up, you know, if David does indeed hate Saul, maybe you're like, well, you're my man forever now. You brought me these things. I'm going to take care of you. Maybe you're going to have the job as armor bearer going forward, you know, and perhaps that's what's going on. You don't know why this guy would be all by himself. What's this guy even doing there? This seems like a dude that is making a play here to get something, and he's going to get something.
Yeah, he is. And I think we'll have a hint of what he's looking for as we hear a little bit more about who he is. We'll get to that in just a second. So between verse 10 and 11, between the closing words that he speaks and David's response, you kind of got to pause and ask yourself, okay, you know, what's going to happen? What's David going to say? How's he going to react? Is he going to say, thank God my enemy's dead? Is he going to do the exact opposite? Is it kind of be some combination of the two? Well, we find out that there's no doubt whatsoever how David feels about this, because verse 11 begins this way. David took hold of his clothes and tore them, and so also did all the men who were with him. So this is this rending of garments that I mentioned earlier. And they didn't just do that. They didn't just kind of visually and physically express their grief, but they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the people of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword.
Now, I have to assume that this guy, as these hours are going by, and these people are ripping their clothes, and they're weeping, and they're not eating, and this guy's just there. So this is a lot of time for it to sink in that you have miscalculated what you have just done. This has got to be an intense couple hours for this guy. He's got to be thinking, so far this has not gone exactly the way I was thinking of it. That's one thing that's going on. This guy's not all of a sudden disappeared. He's still around. The other thing is that this reaction, I think, I'm sure it's shocking to this Amalekite guy that this is how they're reacting, and for good reason, because we've just went through an entire book, 30 chapters, the bulk of which were Saul pursuing, hunting, trying to get David, David being on the run, Saul being driven by madness and jealousy and all this stuff. And one of the things that does sort of make David just different than other people is things like this, where his response to hearing that all of that's over, he doesn't have to be on the run like this anymore. That his pursuer is gone. He's living in, David doesn't want to be living in the land of the Philistines. He has said as much. He's going to get to go home. He's going to get to go back into Israel. You have nothing in the text makes you think that there was like a big sigh of relief from David. David is crushed at hearing this news, which just tells you something about David that is just different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I put myself in the situation, and a situation that I've never even remotely been close to being in. No one has ever, at least to my knowledge, been seeking my life. You know, I've had plenty of people who don't like me, but as far as I know, no one was actually out to kill me. But suppose that did happen. Oh, I can definitely imagine at least breathing a sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank God that's over. I might not rejoice at their death.
Probably wouldn't fast.
But I certainly wouldn't be tearing my clothes and mourning and composing and sitting down to compose a hymn of lament over the death of this person. So that does. It really does set David apart. And, you know, we've talked about
people I like have died and I haven't done those things.
It's true, right? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So imagine our response, the typical human response to this. I mean, it does show you the, I don't know what words to choose. Deep just doesn't sound like it's a strong enough word, but the incredibly deep respect that David has for the office of the Lord's anointed. Yeah. And this of course, was reflecting on this morning when I was going over this text, just takes us forward all the way to the Messiah. And just the way that David thinks about the small M Messiah, Saul, that is the anointed Saul, and then how he regards his own office when he becomes king, informs us just to, I mean, if you take that and you just elevate it, as much as you can to the office of the capital M Messiah, it just shows you what a gift he is to, not just of course to Israel, but to the new Israel, to the church, to the people of God. This is the one that the Lord has anointed to be king. And at the same time, then that also underscores just what it's a gift that the Messiah was crucified, of course, but at the same time, it really underscores the horror of it as well. Because if David wouldn't so much as touch the Lord's anointed, even though that particular anointed wanted him dead, we'll then just take that and apply that to the death of the anointed one, the Messiah. And you get the perspective.
Yeah, and I mean, and I'm sure some would say, well, you got to remember, I mean, Jonathan's like his best friend, and he has also heard that Jonathan's dead as well. And this is certainly part of it. I'm sure this is part of the grieving process. But as we continue, you will see that it's not only that. And it might not even be, that might be deep, that might hurt very, that is a deep hurt that David is experiencing, but it is not the primary thing in this mourning that's going on, and it's not the primary thing that he's going to say next. He'll bring up Jonathan in this lament, but when he turns back to address this Amalekite, this is all about Saul.
Yeah. Yeah, so verse 13, we'll pick up this engagement between David and the young man. David says to him, "Where are you from?" Of course, he's already asked him that. He asked him, "Who are you?" This time he asked him, "Where are you from?" And he answers, "I'm the son of an alien or a sojourner." It could be translated either way, an Amalekite. Now, this is I mentioned earlier, I think this is part of his motivation. So he is a sojourner, and a sojourner has really no rights in the land of Israel. So I think what he's going for here is to, maybe he wants some land from David, maybe he wants a position. He's looking for something that's going to give him more financial life kind of security than a sojourner typically has. So that's probably the reason he describes himself this way. But David says to him, "How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" And David called one of the young men and said, "Go, cut him down." So he struck him, and he died. And then David said, "Your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" So this guy basically pronounced his own death sentence when he said to David what he did. The biblical language of "your blood is on your own head" is found all over the place. We saw it in the case of the two spies when they went to Rahab and Jericho. We'll even hear this again in the Gospels when the people say of Christ, "His blood be on us and on our children." So blood being on us or blood being on our heads is the biblical idiom, meaning let the responsibility for this be on us. So David is saying the responsibility, the blood is on this guy's own head. He's the one responsible for his own death.
This phrase too, I mean, this guy says, you know, "Here's who I am and here's where I'm from." David just said, "How is it that you were not afraid to do this?" And you have to remember, this is coming from the lips of somebody who had opportunity and reason to do this and did not.
Yeah.
He said, how is it that you were not afraid to do this? I was afraid to do this. Saul's armor bearer was afraid to do this. And now, of course, we know this guy didn't do this, but the fact that this guy apparently would have, or David, and David doesn't know that he didn't, and he has pronounced that he did. David cannot understand how it is that you could, that you would have the hubris to do such a thing. This question is, it's just an interesting phrasing of a question. Like, how is it that you were not afraid? You should have been afraid, and because you weren't afraid, you're gonna have to die.
Yeah, I think it also shows the huge difference between an Amalekite's perspective on a king, and then David, and hopefully most Israelites' perspective on a king. This, in other words, this isn't just someone who sees the throne. It's just someone who happened to, you know, inherit the throne, or got there any other way. Rather, they are anointed. That is to say, God put them there. So how is it that you could stretch out your hand against the one whom God himself has chosen and placed into this particular office? Because in so doing, you have stretched out your hand against God himself.
Yep.
By striking down. Even, and keep in mind, this wasn't like the Amalekites said, hey, I saw Saul in the field. I figured you wanted him dead. We had this, you know, this great sword fight, and I got the upper hand, and I pierced him through. No, I mean, this was a killing that this Amalekite claims to have done when Saul actually asked him to do it. So that heightens the fact that for no reason whatsoever should anyone ever put out their hand to strike the Lord's anointed.
It seems to me that maybe the reason that he's also saying that, one is maybe just to say, hey, I didn't actually kill him. I just put him out of his misery. But also, if you come across his body and you're stealing stuff on it, and it looks evident to you that this was a suicide, or, he did not die. I mean, he was wounded, but the death blow was self-inflicted, or at least passively inflicted.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, well, I probably need to try to make my story match what this body looks like, because obviously he didn't take the body. Now, that happened later, I assume, that after he came upon the body, other people came upon the body and took it. But he doesn't really need to get back into Israel with David if his plan works and have people say, well, I don't know, when we found the body, this, it looked a whole lot like, it didn't look like he had been in a sword fight and died that way, you know. So he's kind of going along. He's weaving his story to go along with what he thinks the evidence is going to imply, I think.
Yeah, he was a good enough liar to get himself into some serious trouble.
Yeah,
let's put it that way. Okay, so that's the first 16 verses, and that wraps up the basic story of this encounter. The rest of the chapter, which is 17 through 27, is this famous lament that David sings over both Saul as well as his close friend, Jonathan. Keep in mind that this kind of structurally in 1 and 2 Samuel, that this is an echo of how Samuel began. Remember, we had the song of Hannah toward the beginning of the story. Now, in the middle, we have the Song of David, which, by the way, is the very first recorded Psalm of David. I'm not saying it's the first one he wrote, but it's the first one that's actually given to us that's recorded in the life of David. We know that he was a skilled musician, and based on that, we assume he also wrote songs, but this is the first one that is actually recorded in his life story. And then we'll have another one in 1 Samuel 22 and 23, so the whole structure of 1 and 2 Samuel is built around these songs. So David chanted with his lament over Saul, chanted this lament over Saul and Jonathan, his son. And he told them to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. That's translated different ways by various versions. ESV follows the Greek translation, the Septuagint there. It's a little bit unclear in the Hebrew how to translate it. Doesn't really matter, but you'll encounter different translations there.
But what is interesting about it, what seems to be implied here, is that David wants this lament that he's about to give to be taught to the people. And so this isn't just something that David feels, but he thinks that all of Israel should feel this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's I think it's significant for a couple of different reasons. First of all, remember that Saul died by his own hand. He fell in his sword. And David's response, of course, we've seen so far, he rips his clothes, he fasts, he's mourning, but he's also going to chant this lament over Saul. So he does not treat his death as somehow kind of a shameful act. Instead, he treats his death as that which is to not only be lamented, but publicly, verbally lamented, and as you point out, even to be chanted by the people of Israel. So his response to Saul's death is that which laments the death, not the means by which he died.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is striking is that, you know, someone like David, again, a lesser man, may be like, okay, Saul's dead. Even if you're upset about this because this was the Lord's anointed, and theologically you have reasons to say this is a bad thing, and okay, we got to kill this guy. What you don't have to do is write a song that you say needs to be taught to other people. I mean, part of this seems to be David desiring that people not forget Saul and Jonathan, that David wants the people of Israel to remember them, and to remember them as we get into the lament, which will be next week, to remember them in a positive way.
Yeah, in fact, some of the language that he uses here is, when you first read it, if you're not kind of familiar with the typical hyperbole that you will find in Hebrew poetry, you might read it and you'll think, that doesn't really sound like the Saul and Jonathan that I knew. It talks about how they were beloved and pleasant, you know, in life and death, they were not parted. And you might like, whoa, I remember back in 1 Samuel where Saul was throwing his spear at Jonathan. What are you talking about? But this is a typical poetic, hyperbolic way of Hebrew poetry to speak. And I think it's worth noting, this is another thing that just struck me this morning. You know, what happens when people die that are close to us, that we are grieving for some reason? Well, we tend to do what? Do we tend to focus upon maybe some negative things that we remember? Well, no. I mean, you go to any funeral, almost any funeral, and you're going to hear a lot of praise of the person, you know, either from the pulpit or at least in conversations. People are reflecting upon positive things about them. They're remembering that which is good. They're not focusing upon, you know, whatever might have been negative. Instead, they're highlighting how these people, in one way or another, were God's gift to others.
Yeah.
And I think it's not only what's going on here, but I think it's just very instructive for us, you know, to make it practical. It really gets under my skin when someone will die today, some public figure who is controversial for some reason. And people begin to not... people who are kind of on the opposite side of that person, either theologically or politically or whatever the reason might be, when people will begin to rejoice over their death. Well, I think it's helpful to remember how David responded to the death of Saul. He lamented over this. He certainly never came close to rejoicing over it.
Yeah, I mean David really lionizes Saul in this lament. And I think it's you can look at it and realize that David is choosing to remember Saul in a certain way in his death. And you know, as when David was had one of his last conversations with Saul, and he said, "May God treat me the way that I've treated you," right? And if we see David treating Saul again, I think in the way that David wants to be treated by God, probably in his death. And this is the way that the Son of David treats us in our death, that he doesn't bring up, you know, you don't die and then go stand before God and he brings up all the horrible things you did and all your flaws and all your sin. No, he said, you get a well done, good and faithful servant. I mean, this lament is as much of a well done, good and faithful servant on the lips of the first David that you can get, right? For a man who is obviously a sinner.
Yeah, and what a great way to wrap up this episode. this is how you want the Son of David to speak to you, and how he will.
Yeah, that's it. All right, well, next week we'll get into it. We'll get into David's lament, the first song that we have recorded from him. There's a lot to go over there. So, Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right, see you then.